First Palm Media. You are listening to Mushing on First Palm Media. Visit our website at mushing.com.
Hello and welcome, everybody. This is Robert, and you're listening to the Mushing Podcast. And today I am joined by Jeff Dieter. He's calling in from Fairbanks, Alaska. Jeff, how's it going today?
It's going great, Robert. Thanks for having me on.
Well, thank you very much for joining us. I know you were on our show many years ago, and a lot of things have developed since then. But for folks that may not know who you are, can you tell us quickly who you are and what you're all about, please?
Yeah, absolutely. So my name is Jeff Dieter. I grew up here in Alaska, moving around the state, and first was introduced to sled dogs when I was just a little kid, 6 years old, living in Norvik, Alaska, where the Kobuk 440 runs through. And so that was my first exposure to dog racing. I got really excited about having a dog team and traveling the Arctic. And eventually that dream became a reality when my parents met an Iditarod musher named Frank Seeler when we were living in Wasilla. And I started handling for him and his wife. They had a kennel of 80 dogs at the time. And I was scooping poop and doing chores, and they got me into racing dogs. They were racing, so I got started racing. I ran my first Iditarod at 19 in 2008, and that was running a group of dogs that I had helped raise with Frank and Claudia Seeler. And then after that Iditarod, I had to figure out a way to pay for my dog habit and decide what I was going to do with my life in terms of a career. So I actually came to Fairbanks to attend the university up here, and that didn't last long. I think I was in school for a total of a semester and a half. Really, I was meant to be a career dog musher, but I decided to pursue tourism. That for me was really an excellent fit. I love talking to people about the world of dog mushing and educating people. And I worked in summer tours for years down in Juneau, which is where I met my wife, Katie Jo. And once we became serious about having dogs together, we started Black Spruce Dog Sledding, which is our home-based tour business. And we've had that business now for almost 13 years. So people come into our kennel, we educate them about sled dogs and racing dogs and how they live. People get to meet our dogs, help us hook up a team, and then we take people out on the trail for about 40 minutes to an hour, giving them the opportunity to see, you know, these real racing dogs doing what they love. And that's been a pretty awesome experience for us and for all the people that visit us. And it's really allowed us to gain a great support network. We have a lot of sponsors that we've met through our tour kennel, and that really supports our racing addiction that we have.
That is awesome. And that's one of the main reasons I wanted to talk to you today, Jeff, was about that tour business and how that sort of fits into the mushing lifestyle. And I want to jump into that in just a second. But you had mentioned that you ran your first Iditarod in 2008, took a bit of a break and then jumped back into it, and have run every year with the exception of this past year when your wife ran herself. And I'm anxious to have her on the podcast very soon. I know we're working out some scheduling with that. So let's talk a little bit about your racing experience first. I guess my first question is, how do you think either you or the race has evolved since the time you started, what is that, almost 14, 15 years ago compared to now?
Yeah. So the Iditarod is really a different race from what it was in 2008. My first year, it was a record field. 113 of us signed up for the race. I think 97 started. And this last year, 2024, there were 39 of us that started the race, I believe. So it's definitely become a smaller field of participants. And that's for a few different reasons. And that's kind of a whole nother podcast, I think. But really, the expertise and the knowledge that the current mushers have that are running Iditarod far exceeds that of what most participants had 15, 20 years ago. It's a pretty elite group of mushers that are racing anymore. And some people that are really focused on positive quality dog care, and really excellent, dogmanship out there on the trail. So it's a really fun group of mushers that are currently racing. Probably the biggest thing that I've seen evolve with mushing over the last 20 years has really been the breed. Our Alaskan Husky has just become so good. I mean, they're an incredible dog that is very trainable, incredibly athletic, and more mushers are kind of tapping into really the best genetics out there. And so most of us are running a dog that is very similar in a lot of ways. I mean, we have, you know, slightly varied genetics, but everyone's team from the first place, you know, Dallas this year, to your last place, Jeff Reed, have some excellent bloodlines and really excellent running dogs. And you can see that just in the way the dogs are finishing Iditarod, the way that they're moving down the trail. It's the quality of the Alaskan Husky is just always improving, which is pretty neat to see.
I really like that, Jeff. And as I'm sitting here listening, I think a lot of listeners will compare what you just said to sort of how NASCAR or auto racing is set up. You have this elite core group of drivers in that sport, and they have a lot of the same setup in terms of their cars. You know, all the cars are relatively the same, as you were talking about with the dogs. Do you think, Jeff, that even in that short amount of time since 2008 till now, that the dog has literally evolved from what it was then to now just by that genetic profile?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I think that's clear. You know, there's Lance, you know, was an incredible musher and really had some pretty amazing dogs. And lots of people bred to one of his main studs, a dog named Zorro. And so, you know, it's probably half of us in Iditarod have Zorro Prodigy in our team. And so there's been a few specific dogs from different mushers, you know, Lance and then Jeff King and lots of other successful mushers over the years that have really helped us build this incredible dog that is, you know, its own, you know, it's its own breed, but has enough diversity that we're still avoiding, you know, inbreeding and passing on, you know, potentially negative genetic effects with the dogs. And so, I mean, that's really neat to see that, you know, mushers are really doing some smart breeding and honing in on this really awesome dog. But yeah, it's, I would say that it has changed, you know, dramatically even in the last 20 years that I've been involved.
If I could stay with that for just one more question, Jeff, a lot of people that listen obviously are not dog mushers. They're just fans of the sport or fans of dog sports and dogs in general. Can you speak on what makes that high caliber Iditarod dog? Is it feet? Is it something in their head? Is it body build? A little bit of all of it? Explain it to a fan if you can.
Yeah, absolutely. And this is actually something that we talk about every single day at our tour business, because it's something we really are passionate about and people, you know, have a lot of questions about. And the Alaskan Husky really is made for endurance travel like that. With our, you know, Iditarod mushers specifically, we're breeding a dog that can run thousands of miles in a year. And the first thing that we're looking at is desire, you know, how much that dog likes to run. So those are the dogs that we're breeding first and foremost. So the dogs that finish our 1,000-mile races and are just pumped for more. So that attitude is super important, and it is something that they pass on through their family. We then look at a whole list of physical traits, right? Strength of the feet, composition, the way the dog's body is put together, the health of their joints, their muscles. We're trying to breed dogs that are really resistant to injury. So that would be like muscle strain or joint injury from repetition moving down the trail. Appetite is huge, you know, so dogs that just want to eat and want to always eat more. And it sounds funny, and I think most people with pet dogs, you know, are going to say, well, you know, my dog likes to eat. And it's true, you know, most dogs when they're sitting at home like to eat, but we have dogs that are consuming 12,000 calories a day. You know, that's 6 pounds per dog per day. That's a tenth of their body weight that they need to eat every single day to keep that fuel intake up to make it down the trail. And not every dog thinks eating a tenth of their body weight a day is fun. And so we're breeding dogs that think that, yep, I want to take in, you know, 12,000 calories today and I want to take in more. That's a dog that we're like, okay, we want to breed this dog. And then of course those genetics, you know, looking at family history. So not only what this individual dog has done in our team, and their ability, but what their siblings are doing in our team, what their parents and grandparents and great-great-grandparents and great-great-great-great-grandparents have done. You know, tracking that genealogy is important, and genetics do matter. And so, you know, that's a huge part of our breeding as well.
Thank you for that description. That's really going to help, I believe, Jeff. So let's switch gears and start talking about your dog tourism business, Black Spruce Dog Mushing. I know you guys have been around for a while. We've spoke about your guys' company several times on our Iditarod coverage over the years, and you guys are doing things right. And I want to First, talk about the differences in the types of dog mushing tours there are. And I think a lot of people are introduced to dog mushing on the glaciers. They come up to Alaska on a cruise. They do a day excursion or whatever, and they get introduced that way. And then you have what you guys are doing more in the interior of Alaska. Then other people have kind of meet and greet puppy tours where they come and do kennel tours and that sort of thing. Can you tell us sort of the compare and contrast the different types of tourism that there is for the sport of dog mushing?
Yeah. I think sled dog tourism, you know, really runs this wide range of different levels. And so what you have with the summer tourism in Southeast Alaska geared towards people coming off the cruise ship is really like a carnival ride, an amusement ride. And there's nothing wrong with that, but it's a very quick experience in which people don't really get an understanding of the sled dog and what the sled dog does and how the sled dog lives. The entire kennel and camp setup in the summer for people coming off the cruise ships is really geared for tourism. So the dogs are living in a temporary environment and they're running a very short loop, and it's a turn and burn style tour. I worked for years in glacier tourism as well as ground tourism in Juneau, and we'd see sometimes 350 people in a single day. So when you have that many people, it's really difficult to dive in depth into people's questions. And so that's kind of your first model of tourism, is it's very short, fast paced. There are then other style, like meet and greet tours. People can come in, pet some puppies, learn a little bit about the Iditarod. Typically, you know, that is the world's most famous race. And so a lot of tourism outfits are talking about the Iditarod. People can ask a couple questions, but then they got to move on to the next part of the show. You know, get on the sled, hopefully for a quick ride, or get on the cart for a short spin through the woods. Maybe watch the dogs pull an ATV. That's common as well, especially in some of the warmer climates here in central Alaska. And then your next style of tourism is more what we do, which is really like in depth. You know, focused on education. Really small groups that can spend some time in a mushing kennel and really learn about the dogs. And so our customers come up to our kennel. They are introduced to how sled dogs actually live, what their 365 day a year housing looks like, how we interact with our dogs, how we train our dogs. We get really into talking about racing, of course, because that's what my wife and I are passionate about. And so getting involved with like what it's like to camp out on the trail for days at a time, and what it's like to travel 150 miles a day, and how we do that and how we survive the elements. People are really fascinated by that. Reality television has gotten people interested and excited about Alaska, but there's still so many unknowns there for most people in the world. So it's fun to kind of fill people's head with some of the knowledge that we have. And then of course with our business, people are also getting a dog ride. And so in the summer we do ATV tours. So we actually have a side-by-side ATV that people ride in with me, and I drive a fairly large team down the trail. So 16 to 18 dogs, and that's enough power that I can actually put that ATV in neutral and run for half mile at a time with the dogs just pulling that dead weight on flat ground. And so people can feel the energy and the power of, 16 to 18 dogs. And then that ATV has an engine, so I can help the dogs through soft spots in the trail and uphills. We live in a really hilly environment. So it's really a training tool, and people can kind of go on a training run with me, which is fun. There, of course, is also the next level of dog mushing tourism, which is like multi-day trips. And that's something that we did a little bit when we first started our business. We don't do anymore, but there are still kennels that offer that. And that would be more like your expedition style, where people learn to drive their own dog team and then go out into the wilderness with their guide for a couple days to a week. And that is really cool. But for a competitive racing musher, that just takes up way too much time. I don't have the time in my schedule to be with people for that long. I need to be able to focus on my race team and actual race training. And so our model has worked really well to bring in people, educate people. They support our lifestyle. That's our number one income source, of course, is running tours. But then I still have time to work with my race dogs and try and shoot for winning Iditarod in the future.
So how do you get your, I know that you guys are very high rated on TripAdvisor and that sort of thing, but how do you guys get your clients up in Fairbanks? Obviously, it's a lot easier down in Southeast. You know, you literally have a funneled client base in that model. How are you guys attracting your clients up there, so far from where a lot of tourists are?
Well, I think that people that don't live in Fairbanks aren't familiar with the winter tourism, but Fairbanks gets an incredible amount of people every winter. They're here for the Northern Lights. So Aurora viewing is, you know, very popular, and we have one of the best places in the world to try and find the Aurora and look for the Northern Lights. We've got clear skies, we're at the right latitude, and we have a lot of other activities that have kind of developed around Aurora tourism. And so that's where most of our winter clients are coming from, people that are coming here specifically to view the Northern Lights and then looking for other winter type activities. And so our website is high ranking. So when people search, you know, dog mushing in Alaska, dog mushing in Fairbanks, we're one of the top search results. But then we also advertise with some of the different local tourism agencies here in Fairbanks to make sure to get people funneled towards our kennel. And that's been really beneficial. Now, in the summer, we sort of have a totally different market, a totally different group of people that we're appealing to. So people that are traveling the entire state, they're a part of cruise ship packages, some independent travelers as well, RV types, you know, people that are driving the state on their own. But a lot of people that are here with Princess or with you know, Carnival or any of the different cruise ship operations, people will fly into Fairbanks and then take a bus down to Denali and then down to Seward and then get on their boat to sail south, or vice versa, you know, come up north on the boat and then take a bus through the interior. And that's a totally different marketing style. So we basically have to appeal to those people in a different way than what we do in the winter. And that's more difficult. We're not nearly as busy in the summer as we are in the winter. But honestly, that's okay. It's just my wife and I that run our business in the summer. And so we've got lots of work that needs to be done on the property. With our racing kennel, we have so many things that we need to like get ready for winter. We've got our puppies that we need to be working with and training. And we do typically two tours a day in the summer, one in the early morning, one in the late evening, trying to capitalize on the cooler parts of the day for our dogs, making sure that they stay comfortable while they're running. And that's plenty for us. We don't want to have large bus loads of people coming up to our kennel. That doesn't appeal to us in terms of a tourism style.
So let's switch gears again and talk about your dogs. My first question is probably on the forefront of a lot of people's minds is, can a tourism type dog kennel that does these relatively short runs, can that be successful in long distance mushing? How are you training your Iditarod dogs to do both tours and long distance, or is it two separate teams you know, that are doing their thing?
No, I think this is a pretty interesting topic. And I think there's this misconception among mushers that you can't tour and race, that those two don't work together in the winter. And that is not at all the case. I mean, Dallas, you know, all of us in the top, well, I shouldn't say all of us, what was it, four of the five of us in the top five Iditarod this year run tourism kennels. So you got Dallas Seavey, and he's got his tourism outfit that he's running all summer. But then is still doing winter tours as well. And we're the same. So it's basically the same group of dogs that does everything. And Matt Hall is the same. He's running tours all winter long. And then, you know, placing second in Iditarod this year. And so we have to structure our dogs' time appropriately to make sure that we have the opportunity to put on those longer runs and get in those series style training events where we can go out for 3 or 4 days at a time and really do the back-to-back runs that are so important for building a long-distance team. But then our dogs are still, they're blue-collar dogs. So they come home, they get a day or two off, and then they spend a couple days running loops and meeting people. And that's really, I think, really important. It gives the dogs a pretty well-rounded winter. They get a lot of different experiences, and they have the opportunity to sort of take it easy and harness, you know, and not every single run that they're doing all winter long is so hyper-focused on race training. And so we see that it keeps our dogs pretty mentally alert and engaged, and it keeps them, you know, active, which is really fun. This year, we structured our tour schedule and our training schedule to work cohesively with each other. So in years past, we've just had our business open 5 to 7 days a week, and then we train just around our tour schedule. And so we're out late at night trying to do runs, and we're filling in, you know, fitting in camping trips as we can around our tour schedule. And so this year, Katie and I set up our business that we were open for 5 to 7 days at a time and then closed for 5 to 7 days at a time. And that gave us the time to go out and train appropriately and put that put those longer runs on the dogs and also give them some time off. You know, a lot of people forget, but time off is just as important as that time training. You know, those days of rest are pretty critical for your race team. And so budgeting that for the dogs was pretty key. And then we are fortunate that during our winter season, we have a couple of contractors that work for us at our tour kennel. And that I see with a lot of mushers that are running tour kennels and also racing, that they have other mushers supporting them in their tour business. And so we're the same. We have a few good mushers that come over with their dogs and run tours for us with their dogs. And so that gives our race team a break as well. And that's pretty key. And that really helped with our success this year.
I really like that business model, Jeff, that week on, week off type thing that you mentioned. I think that's a heck of a good way to go. And honestly, I'd never thought about that, but that's how we do our training here as well. Is we'll do three on, two off, or whatever. And like you said, that rest is so important in terms of and just rest in general for both humans and canines. So with your dogs, Jeff, I believe you said right before air that you have 40-ish plus dogs in your kennel. I always ask this question. It's a difficult one for a lot of people to answer, but can you tell us a quick story about one of your favorite dogs and why it is a favorite? And I know that's tough because we all have so many stories about all of them.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I could go on for literally days about our dogs and all of their unique personalities and the things I find interesting with them. But I do have one dog who's quite special. His name is Bravos. And Bravos has been my main leader now in Iditarod for the last five Iditarods that I've run. So he finished his first in lead in 2018 as a two-year-old. And then he's gone on to basically cross the finish line in almost all of the Iditarods that he's run since then, cross the finish line and lead. And he's a pretty amazing single leader. So he's a dog that has actually continued to develop and improve with time. So he just finished fourth place with me this year as my single leader coming across the finish line. And he's 9 years old. So he'll have his ninth birthday a couple months from now. And he just is a unique individual. I say that we co-manage the team because he really has this air about him that garners respect from the other dogs. He's kind of a fiery attitude. No one really wants to get in his way, but when he gets a harness on, he is all business, and he will really manage that team with me. So I'm communicating with him and I'm directing him out there on the trail, but he is also making some of his own decisions, and I let him go and play, you know, and times when we're in a ground storm on the way to the Topcock shelter cabin and I can't see the trail, I just trust that he's going to be up there making his own decisions about where to place his feet and where to take the team. And he's incredible. Basically, the more difficult the conditions get, the better he gets. And wind is really one of his like perfect weather conditions that he runs through. So we get in 2022, Katie and I were weathered down in a ground storm on the way through the Topcock Hills. So going from White Mountain to safety, we got stuck in a ground storm and the wind gusts are probably close to 80 miles an hour. And there was a sustained wind of about 60. And he was able to continue to lead the team basically until I could no longer drive the sled. And so he's running at a 45 degree angle to the ground, basically leaning into the wind, getting blown sideways, but still able to hold that team in the right direction, and has that perseverance to just like lean into his harness and take the team into it. Basically when it seems impossible, he's willing to try it. And that's a pretty cool thing to have in a leader. I was watching him this year run through the Dalzell Gorge. We have a couple of water crossings there. And one of them this year was fairly wide. It was about 7 feet and it was on a 90 degree turn. And I'm coming around this brush into that 90 degree turn. I know that the water crossing is going to be coming up, and he, without missing a beat, leaps the water in one stride. Basically he hesitates for half a second to allow some slack in that line, and then leaps the whole creek crossing, a 7 foot wide crossing, and takes the whole team right through it without missing a beat. And that type of expertise in a leader is really incredible. Like he knew that he had to hold back for two steps in order to put that slack in the line so he'd be able to jump, but yet doesn't hesitate to get tangled up with the dogs behind him. Totally knows how to guide them through that. Yeah, he's just an amazing dog, and he's reaching the point where he, you know, retirement's on the way for him. He's nine, but it's going to be a tough day to say goodbye to him from the race team because he's such a beneficial team member.
The true Gus in Iron Will moment there with your dog, right?
Yeah, I guess so. Yeah, he kind of has that storybook feel to him for sure. And he's the father and grandfather to about half of our kennel now, which is pretty neat. So a lot of his prodigy will be racing with me in years to come.
And that goes right back to what we were talking about at the beginning of the episode, just how important that development of genetics and good breeding and all that just comes full circle, doesn't it?
It really does. Yeah. Yeah. And it's neat. He had a couple kids that were racing with me this year. So one of his sons is a 4-year-old and a couple of them are 2-year-olds, and they did some leading as well. And I did a rod, and I could see that those traits coming through in them. And so I know in the years to come, I'm going to have some more great leadership, which is really fun and exciting.
So, Jeff, we have time for two more questions, and I know we did not talk about this one before air, but hopefully you can answer it. Have you ever gotten a question on a tour, and I know that you see a lot of people throughout the year, have you ever gotten a question that was so unique that has never been asked before or stumped you to find an answer?
Honestly, I'm pretty good at finding answers, even when I don't necessarily know the answer. but in all seriousness, we've had I can't specifically remember the question, but I know that recently I had a question. We get a lot of questions related to living off grid. So our whole neighborhood, our house, our kennel is all off grid. So we're making our own power and heating with firewood, and we get a lot of questions from like tech guys that are really into like power systems and electrical systems, and sometimes I'll get questions that stump me there, and I just have to shrug and say I have no idea. But I did get a really interesting one recently, and I'm drawing a blank on what it was, but yeah, no, there's certainly questions from time to time, even related to sled dogs, where I kind of have to at least think about it for a few minutes, you know, and come up with the, like, I might know the general gist of the answer that I want to pass on, but I need to think about a way to condense the information and present it in a way that makes sense for someone who maybe doesn't have my type of background. And so there are times when I have to just tell people to, you know, pause on the question, give me a couple minutes to think about it and, you know, and get back to them about it, which I think is neat. And it's cool with our business model that I have the time to do that with people, where I can say, you know, let me think about that for a few minutes and condense this and get a straightforward answer back to you.
Very good. Well, if you come up with that question, Jeff, let us know, and we'll post that over on your show notes page for sure. So last question here is, and it's a question I ask almost all of our guests, and that is, if a person was just getting started in the sport in any capacity, whether it be recreational or mid-distance or Iditarod or canicross or whatever, if you could give that person just one piece of advice, what would that be?
Honestly, I think that the best thing that someone can do for themselves if they're interested in getting started in any kind of like sled dog sport is to spend a day with an experienced musher in their kennel, whether that's taking a tour from an outfit like ours, where we really focus on education, or spending maybe a couple weeks handling for a musher, or if you have the time, spending an entire season handling for a musher. The knowledge that mushers have to pass on to future, you know, the future generation is really amazing. And that is the way that I learned how to run sled dogs. It's the way that most serious mushers have learned how to run sled dogs. And so I would highly recommend taking the time to try and get yourself involved with a professional musher, even if it's just for a day.
There you have it. Jeff Dieter, BlackSpruceDogSledding.com. These guys are very active on social media, Facebook in particular. Definitely check them out. And if you're up in the Fairbanks area, give them a ring, check out their website, and check these guys out for a tour for sure. Jeff, thank you very much for joining us today, and we'll talk again soon, okay?
You bet, Robert. Thanks for having me on.
Thank you. On behalf of my guest today, this is Robert for the Mushing Podcast, and we will talk to you guys next time. Goodbye.
Are you a fan of the great outdoors? Do you enjoy the thrill of speed and adventure? Then listen up. Introducing Mushing, your ultimate guide to the exciting world of dog-powered sports and mushing.
Whether you're a seasoned musher or just starting out, mushing has got you covered. Get ready to immerse yourself in captivating stories of incredible sled dog races, expert training tips from seasoned professionals, and gear reviews to help you make the right choices for your team. From the breathtaking landscapes of Alaska to the snowy trails of Scandinavia, mushing takes you on a thrilling journey through the world of dog-powered sports. Don't miss out on the latest issue, packed with exclusive interviews with top mushers, in-depth articles on sled dog nutrition, and stunning photography that will transport you to the heart of the action. So whether you're dreaming of competing in the Iditarod or simply want to learn more about this incredible sport, mushing is your go-to resource. Subscribe now and get ready to unleash your passion for mushing. Visit our website at mushing.com or find us on your favorite podcast platform. Mushing, where the spirit of adventure meets the power of the pack.